allow the soothing music and uplifting affirmations to center your heart and mind in an awareness of God's love.
Wake up, my dear sinners. Wake up from your deep rest. Won't you say your prayers and know that you are blessed? I love you, oh, but Jesus loves you the best. And I hope that you choose your own religion.
What's going on, sinners and choosers? Welcome to Choose Your Own Religion. My name is Joe. Thank you so much for tuning in. If this is your first time, I hope you like it. This is not about shitting all over religion. It's not about promoting religion. It's just saying, well, this thing clearly matters to a lot of people. It matters a lot to me because my dad's a Presbyterian minister and I've been all over the fucking map. And we're just figuring out where we stand on it, if anywhere. And I am so honored to have Miles K on the show today. Miles is a stand-up originally from San Diego, and I've always loved his stand-up. He's a smart, articulate, hilarious, and compassionate person. And I was always interested to see where he stood on all this stuff and what he was raised as. And I think he might be the first person that I know of that was raised an atheist. And, you know, maybe there was a time younger in my life where I was skeptical that atheists could be moral people, which, I mean, that seems silly to me now. But I remember I used to believe that. And if I could go back in time to around 12-year-old me, I would explain a lot of things about sex. And I would then play him this podcast to refute that. And so if you want to check out Miles in Los Angeles, every Sunday night at 9 p.m., Bigfoot Lodge, Babe Island is the show name. Check it out. And if you like this show, subscribe on iTunes and Stitcher. Leave a rating or review. Like the page on Facebook. Reach out. This is like my favorite thing I do. And I love all of you for listening, so thank you. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was Jah. So, Thrift is a pure web series, right?
Yep. I have made 4 episodes at this point, and the idea is to take myself and another person who's maybe a comedian, maybe not, into a thrift store and try stuff on and just like interact with the environment. And there's a few things going on which I think make it compelling. The amount of stuff in those places is really crazy, and it's a really weird variety of things too.
Yeah.
And we'd also, it's basically sifted out of the community, so there's, it's sort of like this weird archaeological site for our local community.
Yeah.
And for our culture in general. It's super fun to watch people try on clothes and funny outfits. I haven't been that great about getting people. Probably the best episode I ever did that was like maybe with Greg Edwards.
Uh-huh.
Paige Weldon I did it with too, where I got them to put on lots of like crazy outfits and stuff.
Yeah.
Well, I did get Claire O'Kane to wear a prom dress, which was awesome.
Yeah.
I like those aspects of it. I also just think it's like, in a context like that where there's like stuff to look about and talk about, it's a good way just to get people to converse and to do what I think almost at the core of all of these projects is just like, oh, wanting to watch human interaction.
Yeah. It's a connection in all these weird different focal points.
Totally. And I also, I really like style, and I think clothing is a valid form of self-expression.
Yeah.
So for me in particular, it's compelling. Although I don't know anything about like labels or brands or things like that.
Interesting.
I have a pretty good eye for the quality of the goods.
Uh-huh.
But one respect in which I'm severely lacking as a host of that is to be like, I really wish I could pull off something and be like, oh my God, this label has such an interesting history.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's only made in Maine, and like, it's all derelict fishermen or whatever who weave these shirts.
Yeah.
But instead, I just look at it and I'm like, oh, this is nice, you know, and you should put this on. This is ridiculous, whatever.
Yeah. Have you always been, like, into style, like, since, like, high school, middle school?
Probably middle school is when I started. Well, because my mom dressed me when I was a kid.
Sure, yeah.
And then I wanted to start dressing myself more around sixth grade.
Uh-huh.
And at some point, I realized that I was like, the stuff that I thought was interesting, I'd pick out and wear it, and people would be like, wow, that's really interesting. That's really cool. And I liked the attention that I got from it.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, as time has gone on, I've gotten more interested in it. I've never been super interested in, like, celebrity fashion or, like, runway fashion things. Uh-huh.
Like, high-end.
Yeah, yeah. Street fashion I'm way more interested in. I'm always, like, checking out what people are wearing on the street. I always really like looking at what comics wear.
Mm.
Some comics have, you know, make really interesting choices.
Yeah.
In that respect. And then others are completely in a uniform. So many comics are obviously, like, dudes that are just, like, last thing I would ever think about is what I wear.
Yeah. Like, t-shirt and hoodie uniform.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I did read this really fascinating book, which I'll probably reference continuously throughout our discussion, which is called Sapiens.
Uh-huh.
And the guy has this picture of Louis XIV, who's, like, you know, probably the most absolutist monarch in that period of European history. And he looks so flamboyant.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, yeah, traditionally throughout history, men have been really, really flamboyant looking. That's part of the way that you demonstrated that you were, like, the shit.
Yeah, you're peacocking type thing.
Exactly. And, you know, you look at, like, rock stars and, like, people, you know, other powerful people in, like, the music industry, they do that still, right? But businessmen are, like, so drab.
Yeah.
And, like, our president is, like, he's considered a stylish guy, but it's still just a suit.
Right, yeah.
It's a super fascinating thing. I think it's because so much of our, the way we look at power in our culture comes out of, like, the world of finance and business, and that is such a incredibly, like, stoic and understated culture.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I came from, like, not, my parents are, I guess you would say, like, liberal Christians, but, like, conservative in how we dress. Like, style was not emphasized to me as a kid. And I think I'm just thinking about my own on stage as a comic. I am very conservative in terms of what I choose to wear.
Yeah.
But part of that is, like, I guess the rationalization I tell myself is, like, oh, I don't want to distract. I don't want to, like, alienate people.
Yeah.
But then part of it is just, like, I'm not comfortable. Like, I can't, it's, like, harder for me to make a confident choice. But it feels great when I do. When I do wear something that I'm like, oh, yeah, I really like this. Like, you know?
Yeah, I think it makes you feel a little more superhuman if you can really own some, like, slightly outrageous article of clothing.
Yeah.
And it allows you to be, like, you're like, yeah, I'm going to be this, like, confident character that just, like, steps into a situation and owns it and is, like, you know, that's a great feeling. I know what you mean with, as far as, like, feeling, you got to feel comfortable with what you're wearing on stage, and I think that's huge. And there's this sense in which I think a lot of people feel like the most successful comedians, you know who they are before they've even started talking.
Mm.
You have some strong sense of what they're all about before they've opened their mouths.
Like, in terms of people you've already known about, like, from their credits, or are you talking about somebody you don't know?
I mean, somebody you don't know, but they, like, the way they step on stage and the way they look, you're kind of like, oh, okay, I can kind of tell what this person's about, you know?
Totally. For me, it's like the 2 or 3 second point into them talking. I'm like, okay, it's like there's an instinctual, they either have it or they don't.
Yeah.
You can kind of, and sometimes it's just for that set or not that set.
Yeah, totally. You know?
It reminds me of, like, I'm a huge Fish fan, like the band Fish, and
I can tell you've got a bunch of Fish. It looks like DVD specials here.
Quite a lot of DVDs. I've got more scattered throughout. But their bassist is very, I guess you would, flamboyant, for lack of a better word.
Yeah.
Straight male, but very, like, eccentric in the,
it's
types,
like,
of stuff.
Ecstatic jam band stuff, right?
Yeah. But he had a great quote one time about, like, it's like, yeah, you gotta like your shirt. He's like, part of, like, when I'm jamming, when I'm in, like a when I'm performing and in the flow state and in the zone, like, part of that experience is looking down and being like, oh yeah, that's a cool shirt.
Yeah.
Like, totally. You know, do you feel that too, like, when you're performing a little bit? Or?
Big time. Yeah. Big time. I really want to be wearing something that feels kind of magical. I think a lot of what we do, it feels sort of like wizardry or something, because you say some words,
yeah,
and then you change the way people feel.
Yeah, it's and a spell.
It really is. Yeah. And some of it's making them laugh. Sometimes it's making them think about other things. Maybe you take them to a dark place before you bring them out of it.
Right.
But I was totally obsessed with wizards as a kid, and I still conceive of it. But that's a part of the whole thing, is your, the whole spell you're weaving is this way you look, and you should look like you exude some kind of power.
Interesting, yeah.
Even if it's like, look, even if it's some person that's hunched over and kind of like, they should emanate something. They should, you know, they should be an icon for whatever, like, totem they're invoking.
Right.
That's what I think.
Well, it's like Louis C.K.'s, like, black t-shirt, jeans, kind of classic look. But that is a power, understated kind of, like...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally. And I think even if you look at someone like Stephen Wright, who's, like, kind of eccentric looking, is, like, kind of hunched and, like, down low, you know what I mean? Like, that, too, is... There's something about that that's like a certain aspect of the human psyche or spirit that's like boiled down into something. And you're like, oh, that's what that would look like. That weird, thoughtful voice you have in your imagination where you think weird thoughts that don't necessarily connect up to stuff but are kind of funny or strange or absurd.
Yeah.
He very much, I think, embodies that. And it's...
Yeah.
It's cool.
Do you ever feel like... I was just thinking of like the casting the spell aspect of doing comedy, and do you ever feel like that is like alienating for you? Like as you're doing a bit, maybe you've done like a lot, and you're like, as you're doing it, you're kind of like, I know this is about to produce an effect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When there are moments where I've got to say the words, but the sentiment is something that I don't feel in my bones anymore. That's always a real...
Oh, it's so hard.
It is. It's a huge disconnect. And one thing that's difficult is, you know, in my situation, I can always just drop a bit. If you're someone like Louis, for instance, I mean, he's got to run the bit, I don't know, 100 times at least before he puts it down on the special.
Yeah.
I think the way that people get around that is they build on these things. You know, they don't just keep telling the same joke line for line. It's like they're tweaking it, they're like changing it, they're rearranging it, and so they're still thinking about the thought and they're still actively engaging with it. They're not just like, all right, joke got a laugh, like, you know.
I heard Kyle Kinane talk about that one time, how that's important for his process of like always trying to like think about like, what can I change a word here, can I make it either more clear or more interesting, can I add like a new $5 word that I didn't have originally in there, or something like that. It's that autopilot mode, though, that's killer for me.
It is.
Yeah.
And I think it means you've disconnected from the audience, too, that... Because, you know, if you're really introducing the idea to them and making them feel it, you should, I think, be able to draw off that, too.
But
I've done entire sets where I just, like, went inside myself and was, like, just got through it, you know what I mean? Just did the material to get on and off stage.
It was, do you feel that way with your outfits in terms of, like, I mean, how what's your, like, rotation like?
Well, what I usually want to do is buy things that are not part of a fully assembled outfit so much as where can this fit into this ongoing aesthetic I'm trying to perfect? And that aesthetic is some kind of, like, somewhat hard to pin the time frame. A lot of people have said it's kind of 1970s looking. But Americana, just like look. And so within that, there's no, it's more like the particular shirt or pair of pants I get sick of. But I've held on to some stuff for like, I've got a pair of pants that I've been hanging on to for like 8 years that they're like more. There's less pants left than there were. You know what I mean? Less than 50% of the pants are left.
Yeah.
They're all shredded, like, cords and stuff at this point. And I got a leather jacket I've had for, like, 10 years. This brown leather jacket that I really like. And, you know, it just kind of shifts out. But some stuff that's, like, really got a real niche novelty purpose, it could be, like, a month. And then I'm like, oh, man, I'm just not feeling this anymore.
Yeah, you know? Totally.
Yeah.
Is that part of maybe... Is it like the worn-in type of look? Is that part of the appeal for you with like thrift items, or like that there's a history behind it.
I like that. I do oftentimes like stuff that looks like new,
mm-hmm.
but I'm also big into, I don't think we need to keep making as much stuff. You know, there's plenty of perfectly good stuff out there, and buying secondhand is something I'm very much in favor of, not just for clothes, but like, you know, electronics and mm-hmm. household goods. The only danger with household goods is the bed bugs thing, which is an increasing danger here in Los Angeles. But like,
yeah,
in general, I think, you know, we're going to facing this issue one way or the other, that we're probably going to have to be salvaging a lot more resources than we currently are.
Yeah.
So, you know, you might as well get into it now.
Get on the cutting edge of that shit.
Oh, yeah.
And you grew up in the Bay Area, right? Or no?
I lived in the Bay Area for about a decade. I grew up in San Diego.
Gotcha. Yeah. So that was when you were coming into your middle school thrift.
Yeah.
Identity.
Yep.
See, I was picturing more like, I'm thinking that type of person I think of as a Bay Area type of like thrift, like middle school kid. But
well, I fit in the Bay way better than I ever did in San Diego.
Oh, yeah?
That right now.
How
yeah.
come?
You know, San Diego, it's a real beautiful place, and the big thing there is kind of like, especially where I grew up, it's the beach culture thing.
Uh-huh.
So I surf a little bit. Mm-hmm. I haven't really surfed in years, mm-hmm. but I did back then in high school. But the guys who are really, really into surfing, they're kind of gnarly dudes. I mean, they're like basically jocks
uh-huh.
that will fuck you up if they don't like you or feel like this isn't a beach you should be surfing on.
Wow.
And they're not, you know what I mean? It's an aggro scene. And generally speaking, San Diego is like a lot of, it's pretty square.
Uh-huh, military town.
Yeah. Military town, and generally what people are interested in is like, you know, real estate and going to the, you know, working out a lot, being active, and being successful, and it's not like...
yeah.
There's kind of actually been... There have been points where there's been a really active music scene in San Diego, mm-hmm. and the whole beer... microbrewing revolution thing kind of came out of there, but that just wasn't what I was interested in. Huh. You know, I really wanted to be like a bohemian type person.
Uh-huh.
And I never really got that into the beats or anything like that, but when I read about San Francisco and I'm like, what, entire communities of writers hanging out?
Yeah.
Wow, I gotta go there, you know?
Yeah, that's, man.
Yeah.
That's how I felt when I was a big Fish and then Grateful Dead fan. Then reading more about their biography and their intricate relationship with Kerouac and that whole, you know, acid test type movement.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Completely.
And I'm also thinking, too, of, like, San Diego. I wonder if there's, like... Because originally, I mean, it's a very, like, mission-heavy town. Like, religious... has religious roots going way, way back.
Yeah.
In terms of being, like, a mission and things like that. I wonder if there's some, like, kind of, like... Was it a religious place when you were growing up in it at all, or...?
Parts of it are more religious than others. It was very casually religious when I was growing up there. My dad is an atheist,
mm-hmm.
and he taught me to be an atheist when I was a kid.
Hmm.
And when people would... that conversation would come up with my classmates,
yeah.
and they'd be like, "You don't believe in God?" And I'd be like, "No." And they're like, "Ooh, you're going to hell." Like, he's in trouble. And I was so mad about it.
Wow. What did your teachers say?
Nothing.
Anything? Yeah.
Nothing.
What could they say?
Yeah, they're not going to get involved in that.
They're like, "Fuck no, I'm not saying anything there." Yeah.
You're on your own, kid. So, you know, it's fine, though. And then I got a little older and I started teasing them because, you know, you become an obnoxious teenager and you read a few books on, like, how to punch holes in people's religious faith.
Right.
And you just start putting them through stuff like that, and then you become way more annoying than they are.
Right. Right. Especially, like, for those of us who grew up with, like, the internet, you're just like, oh, I've got, like, all the points, you know?
Yeah.
Were you, so your dad was... Since the first person I've ever heard, like, met, that's so, like, your dad raised you atheist. Was there any kind of spirituality involved with that, or was it just kind of like a blank tableau?
No, I just because everybody in this culture, I think, is introduced to the idea of God and Christmas and Jesus,
mm-hmm.
and
right.
I started asking. I think I was like in third grade or something like that, I started talking to my dad about, I'm like, well, how does it work, you know, to get into heaven and da-da-da, right? And, you know, it's just like, he's like, none of it's real. Like, it's all just made up.
And, easy answers.
Yeah, and yeah. I was just started, like, I didn't start crying immediately, but I got in this huge heated argument with him, and I was like, what are you kidding me? Like, you know, like, without religion, we wouldn't have all this great stuff. And I started trying to list stuff up.
Wow.
And, you know, and I was, like, crying by the end of it, and he was like, oh. You know, he was really nice about it. He was like, look, Miles, he like, tried to console me. He's like, this is the kind of conversation I'd be having with a college student. And I was like, well, at least I'm smart, man. And, you know, and then after that, I was just like, I calmed down or whatever later. And I was like, I guess I don't believe in it either, you know, because my dad doesn't. And he's the smartest person I know. Because, you know, you always assume your dad is like, you know, knows everything. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And... you know, we would talk about that stuff, and he would, as time went on, and he would talk about how he thinks that religion is basically brainwashing, but there was no, like, positive, like we're going to atheist church, or, like,
right.
You know. And as far as the spirituality thing goes, when I was a teenager, he started getting into some pop spirituality stuff, like this author, Eckhart Tolle.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And he introduced me to those books, and I read some of that stuff, and I was studying philosophy in college, so I was introduced to a little Eastern philosophy, but...
Sure, yeah.
He was raised Catholic, mm-hmm. and was totally traumatized by the religious experience,
mm-hmm.
And so I think that his inclination was to feel like, oh, better just not to have any of it in your life.
Yeah.
You know?
That makes sense. I mean, Catholicism is so traumatic for so many people.
Yeah, it sounds like it. It seems like, not necessarily for everybody, but it seems like as an institution, it has some pretty brutal features.
Yeah. Now, when you were reading Eckhart Tolle and various related, like, kind of Buddhist-ish...
Yeah.
Authors. Were you latching on? Were you, like, into it or not?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I really... Well, I remember reading Eckhart Tolle and his whole thing about, like, you know, look, the past and the future, those are illusions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the past is dead. The future is your imagination. So,
yeah.
Be present in the moment. And I was like, wow, what a great idea. As soon as I get my life... perfect, you know, as soon as I get all the success and
right.
the babes and the, you know, I'm swimming in money, I am gonna live in the present, right?
Oh my god, yeah.
And
I think I still do that.
Oh, yeah. Obviously all of us do that.
Yeah.
All the time. And you know, I try to take every once in a while a moment to be like, you know what, things are pretty awesome, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it is difficult because so many of my ambitions are still unfulfilled, and of course your ambitions are completely amorphous. Once you've achieved one thing, you just set your sights on the next.
Yeah, it's I guess it's the hungry beast that's never satiated.
Oh yeah, because it's, I mean, it's all driven by this ego thing, and in our culture is so incredibly. I mean, our biggest celebrity is Kanye West, who's just the living embodiment of the ego.
Yeah,
it's just, you know, me, right? And I find it.
Yeah.
I don't know, it's fascinating, but
it is, yeah.
I thought a lot of that stuff was really cool. I tried like meditating a bit,
mm-hmm.
and I was not very good at it,
mm-hmm.
and then I went to yoga a bit, and I kept doing yoga like on and off for years, but I would say I've had some spiritual experiences, and I had one spiritual experience while I was reading those books. But I have not made a serious study of that aspect of human life, even though I would say right now, in the past year or two, I've come to think to myself it's crucial. Hmm. And that if you don't have some engagement with the spiritual nature of human existence,
yeah.
then... you're not going to be living a fully realized life, to say the least.
Yeah. It's like a passage I just heard again this morning for like the 1,000th time, but like, it's dumb how hard it hits me. Like, it's a from the Bible, from Apostle Paul. He's like, you know, if I have faith to move mountains, if I have speak with the tongue of angels, but I don't have love, then I'm nothing. He's like, if I give up all my possessions, if I'm like a total renunciate, like the perfect monk, whatever, I'm changing his exact phrasing, but it's like, without love, none of it means shit. Like, it's just not going to be fulfilling. I mean, I'm curious, why do you think you've kind of resisted following that or pursuing
it? It just takes time.
Yeah.
It just, I'm bad at studying things rigorously on my own. When I was in college, I could rigorously study things because there was like a real structure around it. Mm-hmm. But
deadlines and
I mean, my whole life, like, you know, I do stand-up comedy. I'm not a independently wealthy. I have to like work a job to support myself. Mm-hmm. And I, like most of us, I've been completely terrified that if I don't work my ass off doing stand-up, I'm not going to achieve any kind of career in this business.
Yeah.
And you know, for so long, too, I thought to myself, well, the only way I'm going to be happy is if I have some really interesting creative career.
Yeah.
Which increasingly I also think is, like, misguided. Mm. I mean, it's good to have a good job.
Yeah.
Without a doubt. Whether or not jobs in the entertainment industry are good jobs seems to me a very opening question.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem obvious from the... I've never been closer to achieving that goal, and it has never been less clear to me whether or not the people that are doing it are particularly more satisfied or happy than somebody who has a less glamorous job that also has a fair amount of autonomy and gets to be a bit creative and blah, blah, blah.
Totally, yeah. I've thought about that, too. I think the more I go on, you know, you start hearing about the types of jobs that are available. I mean, like, for me, I think that the big draw is, like, the idea of, like, free time and then, like, enough wealth to be able to not have to work for long periods. And then, I mean, there's definitely a lot of, I think for me, the still continued lure is it does seem like the entertainment industry, especially stand-up, seems like a path to personal freedom, potentially. Like, if you're the most able to be your truest, realest self more easily than maybe like a lawyer or something. Not that lawyers can't, but no, maybe me as a lawyer, I don't think I could be.
Without a doubt, it seems like, well, if at the very least, it offers you a professional avenue in which you can potentially engage in true self-expression.
Yeah.
And comedy, for particular, is very accepting of all comers in terms of, you know, Dave Attell is like an open degenerate.
Right.
And he's beloved for it.
And, blank. Jim Norton, another one, like, when those degenerate
oh, totally.
Guys,
Maria Bamford is mentally ill to the point where she would really probably be, if she was open about who she is in any normal work environment, she'd be extremely stigmatized.
Yeah.
And for us, we're like, kind of like, wow, that's good material, you know?
Yeah.
Compelling stuff.
Yeah.
So there is that element. I think, too, though, that the way that the industry is structured to make it so easy to exploit creatives, and the fact that the people who are a part of the institutional machinery of it have such incredible security, it seems like to me.
Totally.
And all the artists and creatives are just, with the exception of a very small few, begging for a livable salary or income is very distressing.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, compare that to Silicon Valley, where, like, they fucking pay the talent up the wazoo there. Mm-hmm. You might say it's a supply and a demand issue. There's so many people in L.A. that want to participate.
Yeah.
And seemingly are qualified. Mm-hmm. Whereas in Silicon Valley, there are not as many people as they need who know how to do this thing.
Yeah. Well, and especially in like tech fields or a lot of other fields, it seems like, you know, your salary ideally is somewhat like correlates with whatever value you're providing. And I feel like with tech field, you can more easily point to your resume and you're like, oh, I created this app, so that's worth this amount of money to this parent company or whatever.
Yeah.
Especially in the, you know, in stand-up or in creative fields in general, it's very hard. You have credits, you know, that's the closest thing you have to a resume.
Quantifying your value is difficult unless you're a touring stand-up, and right, then it all just comes down to ticket sales.
Exactly. Yeah. Have you ever the way I'm about to phrase this question, it sounds like, feels weird to me. Have you, because I've not necessarily done this that much in my career, but have you ever, when you're writing bits, have you ever thought like, oh man, this is something that like I think will help people, like I'm communicating, yes, something that will like eliminate,
yes, definitely, yeah? More so than ever lately.
That's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. I want very, my take on the world is that while it is an incredible place and amazing, it is a mix of things that are both beautiful and absolutely awful.
Yeah.
And that most of the time what I see people trying to do is, a lot of people try to just, you know, put a spin on it. We're like, no, the world's basically good. When bad things are happening, it's because certain people didn't do the right things. Mm-hmm. They were irresponsible, or they believed in the wrong God. They try to put responsibility on the victims of catastrophes. Mm. And I think that that's extremely misguided because, first of all, the vast majority of the events in the world are outside of our control. Mm-hmm. And if something, you know, anyone can get hit by a car or a fucking meteor or a crazy gunman who, you know, decides to do whatever, or a disease that breaks out. You know, these things are senseless to a large extent.
Yeah.
You know, so it's not, there's not a lot of rhyme or reason to that. And then I see other people who try to run towards total negativity and be like, you know what, the world is awful, but it doesn't bother me because I know it. I see it for what it is.
Yeah.
And it's all, and you know what, I'm disgusting too. Read my Twitter profile. It's a diary of sadness. Like that.
Yeah.
And I think that that also is like a defense mechanism, mm-hmm, and an attempt to somehow say that you're unintimidated by the awfulness, like you aren't afraid. And I think the reality of it is like, of course we're all afraid. It's absolutely a terrifying prospect what might happen to us,
you know,
and inevitably we're going to die. And presumably when we die, we will stop being conscious in any recognizable way.
Mm-hmm.
I think that if you can come to terms with that, I want in my comedy for people to realize that things are, you know, terrible and terrifying and in some way amazing, and then feel okay about that.
Yeah. So you feel like there's like an alchemical aspect of comedy.
Oh yeah, for sure. And I tend to think that the best comedy tends to make people think about things in ways that they had not previously. Comedy that reaffirms what people already believe. For instance, if you're like a liberal comic that gets up in front of liberal audiences,
right,
and congratulates them on thinking liberal things, and then like you're like, now we got a bunch of straw men we got to get through over the course of this discussion. I mean, I have bits where I make fun of like Ted Cruz, and I talk about how I'm afraid he wants to put like people in camps and stuff. But I don't admire that in the way that I do. One thing I really like about Bill Burr is that and maybe even more so about Patrice O'Neill.
Oh yeah,
is that they oftentimes begin their bits from a place that most of the audience is going to disagree with.
Yeah.
And then what you get to watch is them slowly construct like a compelling argument for their point of view.
Totally.
And even if at the end you don't agree with it, it's just so enjoyable to watch someone walk through that reasoning process.
Totally. They're big idols of mine, I think, largely for that reason.
Yeah, no, yeah, it's really cool. And I mean, I think like a lot of Patrice O'Neill's views on most specifically women are like pretty abhorrent, and if I were a woman, I don't know if I could watch his shit. I mean, it's,
yeah,
I have like you know, I'm a white dude, and like there's so much like comedy right now that I see where people are just like, white guys are the worst, and even when they're making fair points, I'm sitting there being kind of like, fuck you, you know. And
totally,
like, it's not like coming from a place of like, you know, they're wrong or I disagree with them intellectually. It's, I just don't appreciate being shit on. I don't think anyone does, and so I feel like with the Patrice thing, it's a real special flavor that, you know, may not be for everyone. Yeah,
dude, that really resonates with me, and I think especially like, yeah, it's hard not to say fuck you. And as a straight white male, I think about this a lot. It's like the one privilege we don't have, it seems to be like complaining privilege. Like I'm not, you know, I'm not allowed to like voice any kind of complaint. Like, oh fuck you, you've had privilege. And like to some extent, they're kind of right. You know, just I have had the deck stacked for me throughout my life, but that doesn't make it any more like less alienating to me as an audience member to be like, well, all right, well, they're just not gonna like me whatever the fuck I do.
Yeah,
you know. And that's so I think why Bill Burr can be so compelling to white guys, because he's like, finally somebody's standing up for the white guy.
Yeah, I think there's something very interesting about the way he does it too, because I feel like, well, one thing that's really fascinating about those particular set of issues to me is it's very hard to figure out how to dialogue with it. It's,
yeah,
you know, without just, I saw this really funny bit in a web series recently where this girl or her boyfriend starts talking about something related to like lesbians, and he's just like, oh my god, it's so beautiful, right? And she's like, Todd, shut the fuck up, you're a white cisgendered straight man, no one cares about your opinion. He's like, and that's my prison, right? And immediately, yeah, just like so effusively like cutting himself down. And it's a funny like little moment.
Yeah,
but that's not something I feel that guys that do that are generally like, yes, I'm the worst, like, you know, are not being authentic. Like,
yeah,
if they truly hate themselves for these factors about themselves that they cannot change.
Right.
Really?
Never decided in the first place.
No, then that's like, that's crazy.
Yeah.
That would be crazy. Now, to accept that, like, you know, you are handed the situation of an insane privilege is, mm-hmm, like, if you want to, I think, get with the program and realize that, like, you know, things are just really not fair, and a lot of people out there are just like having to take a lot of shit,
yeah,
that you and I are not subject to, you've got to start digesting that stuff. And I think some of it too is learning not to take it personally and being patient with people's frustration and anger.
Totally. Yeah.
But that being said, you know, there's moments where I'm kind of like, it always depends on the person on stage too. Sometimes people, exactly, talk about this stuff on stage and I'm like, man, I feel like you really know where you're coming from. Then there's other times where I'm like, I don't even want to like label it exactly, but there's some people where I'm kind of like, you got it pretty good too. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, I know. Totally, man. Totally. It is tricky not to get caught up. I have so many bits like this that I'm trying to, I think, are funny, and they're not necessarily, they don't have to be antagonistic, or I can make them, mm-hmm, like teasingly fun antagonistic. There's a fun antagonism, and I think that's what comes across with people. Because there are some people who make fun of straight white men, and I think it's fucking hilarious. And
yeah,
it's
totally
wonderful. Because there is like, maybe there is a, maybe a underlying love to that person, like, yeah, coming across, where it's like, then I can be teased, and I'm like, I know it's just, you're just and some level you're just kind of joking around.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I can get sucked totally into that, like, yeah, well, fuck you too, because of this X, Y, Z. And it's not,
when it feels like the person on stage really hates that category,
yeah,
and wants the audience to hate that category, I think at that moment I start to feel kind of threatened, and yeah, that it's very hard to step back from that. That's like one, you know, I've thought about this just in general in life, like, if not just taking it away from comedy, but if someone is posturing to you, like trying to physically intimidate you or threatening to like fight you or something like that,
mm-hmm,
there's a part of me that thinks, you know, violence, not really a good thing. Like, shouldn't, basically violence is wrong. Not to say that I don't believe there are instances where in order to prevent greater violence, one might need to employ violence.
Absolutely.
But it's hard. It's like if someone is trying to physically intimidate me or like wants to fight me or something, which hasn't really happened in years, I think would feel bad about backing down or just accepting or thinking like, well, like, what does this all mean? I know this person's confused, and, you know,
yeah,
or they're just, you know, they're overly aggressive, but that's not my, you know, no need to let their journey impact my journey.
Yeah,
it's hard. It's hard to step away from that, from aggression.
Yeah, I think a lot of these violence, and whether it's verbal violence or physical, I don't know, it's all, I think what that whatever it is, that we feel a disconnect, we feel the disunity that I think is inherently a lie. Like, I think our deepest core truth is we are all one. I mean, it sounds hippie, that's yeah, a cliche overused phrase, but we do all come from the same source at the end of the day. If I had been born in that person's situation with their DNA, I would have been that person.
Yeah.
Like, whoever the fuck it is. And I would have reacted to that set of stimuli in that way. And,
yeah,
you know, God knows I've acted shittily in other different ways. Or, like, for me, I can be a passive-aggressive motherfucker. Like, I'm rarely violent, like, yeah, directly. But I'll just, like, give, like, the silent treatment, or I'll just, like, shun people because I don't know how I'm too afraid of the confrontation, which would actually... There is a level of confrontation that actually leads to unity, I think.
Yeah,
you know?
I know what you mean. It can actually resolve things. And, I mean, there's all this interesting stuff, too, in the way that, like, violence is tied up with our history as a species, and it's been a part of all of our cultures have institutionalized or ritualized violence in,
yeah,
weird ways. I was watching this documentary about... Norwegian black metal bands, the ones that were burning down churches and stuff.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of them are really into the idea of returning to pre-Christian religions, which there are a lot of fascinating things about it. One of which is a lot of the arguments they employ are the same arguments that people employ against cultural appropriation. And they're basically like, you know, Christianity came in, it erased our culture, and we should be entitled to our traditional culture, which has, by the way, been gone for like over 1,000 years.
Right. yeah.
And, you know, all these cultures around the world, they've been erased by, like, you know, Christianity and these other empires, and all these people, they should be allowed to have their own culture. And it's funny because on the one hand, it sounds like an argument for total pluralism, but they're like white nationalists, mm-hmm, too. All of them have some degree of that in their yeah, thinking.
Yeah.
The other thing about these, like, cultures and these religions that are super interesting to me, too, it's like all those, like, Nordic cultures and those Celtic cultures and stuff, they had a lot of beautiful stuff and interesting mythology. They're all warrior cultures.
Yeah.
So it's basically the whole thing is being run by homicidal jocks.
Right.
And there's, like, fucking human sacrifice and, like, you know, just crazy, like, ritualized violence and things. And it's,
yeah,
I mean, there's a part of me that sometimes I look at our current, this is a fascinating thing. So if you look at Europe and what their, like, greatest structures were for, like, long period of time, it's all these amazing cathedrals and churches and, like,
yeah,
religious sites, and they're totally beautiful, and they, you know, there's all these horrible aspects of their, you know, that religion, but also, like, there's a lot of beautiful ideas woven in there, and, like, our way of, like, just mythologizing and conceiving of ourselves in the universe is, like, it's enacted in these places and in their, like, art.
Yeah.
And I think about now, what are our most prominent structures? It's, like, skyscrapers. It's office buildings.
Yeah.
And that's, like...
Sports arenas.
Oh, that's actually interesting.
Yeah.
I hadn't thought about that one. Yeah, sports arenas are huge, which are also weirdly, like, places of commerce, too.
Uh-huh. And violence.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's true. And I don't know. I mean, I do find it interesting in certain respects, like, in that, like, I don't want to return to, like, these warrior cultures where, you know, like, it just sounds brutal to
right,
me, to be honest.
Right.
But at the same time, I look at what our current culture is and the way that... What we admire is just, like, it could just be some piece of shit with a big bank account and stuff. And,
yeah,
like, when I say piece of shit, I mean, too, like, people to me these days, so many of them look sick. Like walking around, like so many people just look like they're like have bad diets, and they're like whatever work they do, whether it be at a desk or some very specific form of manual labor, it's like twisted people up. Like,
yeah,
you know, I do go back and forth on these, this give and take of like, oh, progress versus traditional horrible dark age, you know.
Right. Yeah, I think violence does, it is such a primal, innate, almost unavoidable part of humanity. I don't know if that's because like there's some inherently aggressive nature in all of us that's the thing that wants us to grow and like become better people. Maybe in pre-civilized societies was like, oh, to grow, I have to take somebody else, like what somebody else has. I have to like violently snatch that from someone else. I don't know if you're following what I'm saying.
No, but I know exactly what you're saying. What's super fascinating about it is this book I just read, he claims that one of the big moments of progress in human history was previously people always assumed that in order for you to benefit, it had to be at the expense of someone else. And then like the free market ideology and the ideology of capitalism comes along and says, oh no, we can all become richer simultaneously. We can all grow the size of the pie and therefore all get bigger slices of the pie.
Yeah. It was originally kind of right. In some sense, you know?
Oh, I think overwhelmingly they've been proven correct in terms of the total amount of wealth in the world is just increasing all the time.
Yeah.
The issues of whether it's being fairly distributed are, like, totally different.
Well, in what you're speaking to and what the author is speaking to is cooperation lies at the core of what is going to make everybody grow together.
Yeah.
And when there's such an income inequality disparity and the people at the top don't care about the income inequality, then there's no cooperation going on.
Yeah.
You know, there is more, when everybody's sacrificing a little bit more, it does create a better society, a better place.
Oh, totally.
Yeah, it's not, but now our violence is just totally passive. I mean, we are a passive-aggressive culture in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I mean, some of the most obvious violence is like locking people up in prisons, which there is some active violence that goes on in there, but the main primary form of violence is just that those people are confined and unable to leave.
Yeah.
And then interesting things like forcing people to live on the street in conditions that are not really humane.
Yeah.
That book, by the way, is called Sapiens. And one of the things he gets into, which is super fascinating, is when our species was coming out of this one part of Africa, we came out and we genocided all these other human species that were very similar to us, but not quite, like Neanderthals and Homo erectus. And one of the really interesting things about us is that we started talking about objects that don't exist. So basically fictional or mythological objects.
Yeah.
And the thesis he puts forward, and I don't think it's an original thesis, but it's basically that by talking about these myths, it allowed us to coordinate in much larger groups. So Neanderthals, they were bigger physically and they had bigger brains, but the biggest size community they could form up would be like 40 or 50. It's like a family, basically.
Right.
That's how big you can get, like a family.
Uh-huh.
With human beings, even if you're not like actually blood related to somebody, you're like, wait, you believe in the circle with the eye in the middle of it? Yes. All right, great. Let's get those other guys. Like,
yeah.
And it's pretty cool.
It's pretty accurate too. I mean, that's what we think of churches or of, I think of it in terms of like philosophies of comedy between like improvisers versus stand-ups versus sketch people. It's like, oh, you believe in stand-up as the one true way to
wow, that's, I've never even thought about it like that. What's so fascinating is I don't think either stand-ups or improv people could provide a truly substantive explanation of why one over the other.
Yeah,
like to me, it always just comes down to these personality quirks of like, some people, they want to mostly work on their project with their vision by themselves.
Yeah.
And other people, they're more social. They really want to do a collaborative thing.
Yeah, they want to. Yeah. I've I did a lot of improv. I still do it with a couple groups, but I moved away from stand-up for a while into that kind of, and I did love that cooperative, collaborative type feel. It is more social. It is sort of more reaffirming, and I think stand-up can breed an antagonistic sort of, like,
oh my god, mindset. It's so backbiting.
Yeah,
it's crazy the degree to which there's so much animosity between people in the scene, and it's like, even people that are friends, they have to swallow their jealousy as their other friends do things, and there's so much fear about, like, whether the people that you don't like might get things that will prevent you from getting your stuff.
Yep.
It's insane, man.
Our acts of violence are like unfollowing people on Twitter.
Yeah, exactly. Muting someone. Yeah,
right. You know,
I don't know if I've had to unfollow someone in a long time. Like right before the mute button came out, had to do it. Like where I was just like, I'm sorry, I can't take you.
Your energy is toxic.
Your energy is toxic. When I see your shit, like, both your weird, crazy, like, lashing out at people, and then all of the, like, self-pitying that follows other people turning against you, I don't want to witness this drama, right?
Yeah.
And I unfollowed, and then like 2 days later, they're like, introducing the mute button, and I'm like, ah! You know, because now that, and it's the type of thing too, especially with someone like that, now they assume you hate them. You know what I mean?
Right.
Which, in fact, no, I just think you're like a sick bug that someone needs to step on.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and I definitely get paranoid about who hates me, who whatever. I don't know, and I make, making assumptions about that shit is like one of the, it can create such a negative feedback loop. It can actually manifest the reality of them hating you before they even actually hate you.
You are so much better off if you are capable of doing it, of just continuing to try to exhibit goodwill towards this. I mean, to me, two of the most popular guys in the scene are David Bory and Alan Strickland Williams.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a huge part of that comes from, I'll tell you somebody else who fits the bill, who just came back to visit recently, is Wendy Starling.
Yep, yep.
And it's like, they love to party, all those people, which is like a huge factor. Whenever they show up to a party, they're like, happy to see you.
Yeah.
They like want to shake your hand. Like, they're like, oh, how have you been? Da, 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 right? And they seem like genuinely supportive.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh my god, like having people like that around as opposed to people in the corner who are insecurely glancing over to be like kind of like, and you're like, do those people not like me? Well then fuck them, right? And if you can avoid looking at that, I think, and seeing it as hostility, and instead just being like, maybe they're shy, maybe they're insecure, who knows, I'm just gonna keep being nice, you're way better off. Sometimes those people are still assholes. There's people out there in the comedy scene who are so busy trying to create an in and an out group, it's fucking nuts. But
you're so right though. I mean, I think of those people too, and it's like, it's almost like the myth of like love being lame. It's like, no, those people are self-generating love all the time, and it's like a truly independent of, and that's what love is to me, like at its best. It's not discerning between, oh, I'll love this person but not this person, I'll love this aspect of myself and not this aspect of myself. I mean, I think of Wendy as somebody I really look up to. It's like loving all the aspects of herself, dark or not,
man.
And
she is
inspiring.
She's so accepting of not the human condition, and not just like her own flaws, but like, Jesus, that story she has about getting gang raped and the way she describes it in terms that are just like, yeah, it was horrific, but she doesn't sound judgmental. It's like unbelievable. I part of me is like, I just can't, you know what I mean? It takes some kind of like superhuman understanding to do that.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, and that's why it's like, to me again, that's like, it's, that's love, and in the way that like even the people who do, and that's the shit that MLK preached. I mean, this is nothing even new.
No.
This is the oldest things that religion and their ideal forms have been telling us. It's like,
yeah,
love your enemy.
I no, totally. And to that point of it not being new, I mean, I am extremely skeptical that we've been making any spiritual progress of any kind for a very long time. And one thing I find extremely disturbing is this weird idea that we seem to have, like, it's like, well, like when Ted Cruz was talking about, it's like, we need fewer philosophers, and it's like, well, we don't have that many philosophers, like, we really don't.
Yeah.
And this thing too of like, what do we need philosophers for? We got Silicon Valley and the free market, all your problems solved. And it's like, we keep developing this technology, but we have such an impoverished sense of what to do with this technology. I mean,
yeah,
it really is like, those kinds of solutions will not answer questions of like what's truly valuable.
Yeah, and I think of like our individual self-actualization maybe is stronger, and since I think we're the most independently minded as a collective that we've ever been, but in that same sense, we don't know how to use it as effectively towards a collaborative ends yet.
Yeah.
And I think of especially with the stand-up community, that's something they could definitely learn. It's like, we don't need to make everything us versus other comedians. It's like, yeah, how can we collaborate and actually like bring, like make other people who aren't comedians like how can we make more people into fans of comedy?
Boy, that's a great question.
It's a it doesn't have to be, it's not a zero sum game of like, there's only a certain amount of people that will ever like us or like comedy.
Yes. I agree completely. And I'm totally have been guilty of thinking about it in those terms.
Me too, man. Yeah. Me too. Good shit. Did I tell you the gimmick of this show? We're about at that point.
About inventing a religion?
Yeah. Are you game for it?
Yeah. No, I am.
Cool.
The episode with Peter that I listened to,
mm-hmm,
you guys didn't do it, so I don't know how the game is played.
Oh,
but
cool.
I'm very interested to see.
Awesome. Well, I have bullet points that we can kind of like work through one by one, and it's like, however silly or serious you want it to be, it can be either your ideal, I don't know, it's just making up your own religion, whatever that means to you. So the first overarching question is like, what kind of god structure would this have? Is there like a one monotheistic god? Is there many gods? Or we have like a Greek kind of hierarchy, yeah, system?
Yeah.
No god, like in a Buddhist sense?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I have actually been thinking about the nature of God lately. So I'll answer this stuff as seriously as I can. I tend to think that the universe is trying to become self-aware.
Yes.
And yeah, I think that the idea that there's already an all-knowing God is not true,
mm-hmm,
but that through us and through the machines that we are building and possibly other life out there, if there is any, that there is this effort for the universe to be able to know itself and to see itself, and that we are sort of tools to that end.
Yeah.
So that is the God that I know of. We are trying to make it manifest.
And that kind of answers my next question, which is, what is the overarching ethos? And that is the universe becoming more and more perfectly self-aware, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you ever feel like, I don't know, is there a perfect, like a perfect level of self-awareness? Is that perfect unity? Is that what the end point is?
I don't know. I don't
singularity?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure if all matter becoming a part of an intelligent thinking system is the goal or not. I don't know that there is a goal. Part of me feels that this process is happening very blindly.
Mm.
And the other thing that's interesting about it to me, too, is that there's no indication that this process is entirely benevolent as we conceive of it. It pushes life to do things that are monstrous, not just human beings, but, you know, there are wasps that reproduce by paralyzing spiders and laying eggs inside their bodies, and then the eggs come out and eat the spider alive. It's like something out of a horror film.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure.
Okay. Does our religion have any kind of regular, whether it's weekly, monthly worship or gathering or meeting, or is there any kind of...
Sounds like a good idea to me.
Mm-hmm.
I've really wanted more spirituality in my life. I've thought recently about, like, I'm like, wow, if I want to have more interesting spiritual events, how would I go about creating those? And I've had a few of them, and they usually involve scenarios like, one time I was in this person had this like little forest in their backyard, basically, in this way too hot hot tub, and I was in it, and I was like lying down in a hammock after being in the hot tub, watching steam go up into the air and the sky, and just, you know, felt like really at one with the universe, and like I was having this mystical experience. And I was like, yeah, I definitely seem to think there tends to be a thing with like dramatic lighting and nighttime, and, you know, probably fire or something.
Yeah.
So I'm very interested in developing that. I also think rituals that are completely like fabricated and don't come out of like a cultural tradition and a shared set of cultural symbols are probably bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a really complicated thing to figure out. Is
sure.
How to make the spiritual communal.
Mm, yeah. I mean, so whatever, yeah, within that, I mean, what is your take with the role of like music? Or
I don't know. Music is, I know that there are evolutionary psychologists who talk about why we like music.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that I've ever heard a theory that makes me think that it's particularly compelling.
Yeah.
Our relationship to, sometimes what I think when I think of art, like for instance paintings or sculptures, I think it's really interesting that there is an artifact of somebody else's psyche that's in a room emanating out their something about themselves, and that, you know, you're able to be there and pick it up. And I think I could say something similar about music in terms of, you know, someone found something in their mind that they wanted to crystallize and then share it with you, and it's weird. It's like a weird little ghost of yourself or your band or whatever that continues to go out there and like speak to people and affect them even long after you've maybe died or whatever.
Totally. I mean, yeah, how many fucking great, I mean, Prince just died.
Yeah.
You know, or how many countless amazing artists have left music that still impacts us today. It almost seems like, yeah, it's like one of the last frontiers of mystery.
Yeah.
You know?
Totally.
It's totally unexplainable to me. Like, why does music move me and connect me? So it's like a shortcut to connecting me to other people.
Yeah, totally. And I think you're really into fish, and I can see why, because it seems like what they're all about is creating, like, crazy, like, ecstatic communal events.
Totally.
That where people stop thinking about things the way we do all the time in these like weird commercial status driven terms and just like hopefully turn back into animals for a little bit. And not just animals in a like low base sense, but like I think it's very weird that we don't think of ourselves as animals anymore, because people are like, oh, we're not like animals anymore. It's like, no, we are.
Yeah, we are.
Just totally animals. We just happen to be animals with, like, really, really complex and adaptable brains. But it's like, this.
Yeah.
Here's something I've thought about recently. This is a little bit of a tangent, but, you know, when people, you know, you, like, have fast food or something, like Del Taco, and, you know, there's, like, a dog around there. Go, don't give that to the dog. And it's like, why not? It's like, oh, it'll make the dog sick or whatever, right? It's like, okay, well, I'll eat it, though.
Right, and you'll be sick.
Yeah, like, we're any different.
It's totally, you're a sophisticated dog, like an articulate dog.
Exactly, and what's crazy, too, is those dogs, like, they're a part of our social community. Like, they, like, exist in our families and, like, communicate with us and hang out with us at parties
and
stuff.
We love them.
We do.
Yeah.
We absolutely do. And there's something really interesting about it. But though we look at them and all other animals and be like, not like us. And it's like,
Man, just even today, a friend was having a problem with their dog, and like they're worried about like the cost they might have to take to the vet. I mean, I said this today. I'm like, at the end of the day, you know, it's a tough call, but at the end of the day, it is just a dog. I said that.
Yeah.
What an asshole thing to say.
I mean, I'm totally sympathetic, man. I mean, the other thing, though, too, is I'd be maybe a little more likely than a lot of other people to be like, you know, if the elder relative losing their mind or whatever, I'm like, yeah, there should just be more euthanasia, you know?
Right. There's like all of a sudden the utilitarian part of my like animal brain is like, oh, yeah, cut the dead weight.
Well, I also don't want anyone to suffer unnecessarily. I mean, you know.
And there is, I mean, yeah.
Suicide rate is highest with the elderly.
Huh. I never knew that.
Yep.
Interesting. So within this, within whatever worship kind of we have, do you, is there any role that prayer and meditation kind of?
Yeah, I would think so. I think those things are super important. I don't know a lot about prayer or meditation. Prayer, as I understand it, where you're like conversing with an intelligent God.
Yeah.
Seems hard to reconcile with my picture.
Yeah.
That being said, I, you know, having learned about some animistic religions where they like talk to like trees and rocks and not just like ask them for things but taunt them and like yeah. things like, I find that idea super interesting. The other day I was sitting in my living room lying down trying to see myself as just a clump of matter continuous with the rest of the matter, and I'm like, yeah, this piece of matter happens to breathe in and out, but there's a plant doing something like that right over there, and it's just like the wood is creaking and everything is kind of in flux, and trying just to see it that way. And that, I you know, that was a meditative moment for me.
Totally. Yeah, I think of prayer sometimes as like, I used to, you know, I was forced to pray more or less as a kid growing up, super religious. Say forced, like nobody had me at gunpoint or anything.
Yeah.
But it's like, you know, you're in church, you got to say the prayers, you got to learn the prayers. And then that made me, you know, kind of, once I left the church and wasn't feeling spiritual for and religious, I was like, yeah, fuck prayer. Like, prayer's dumb. Obviously, yeah. I'm not, there's no God talking back to me. But then, like, I've been getting more into it. And it's not, I'm not super consistent with it, but there is like something about communicating your core desires to just a pot to it, it like helps it's like a shortcut to love, like to whatever the universal love that and reminding myself I am worthy of love and my wants and needs, they're not, they don't rule over other people, but they do matter.
No, no, that's totally valid, I think, to acknowledge that you're in this universe, that you want things from it, and to try to put that out there and not deny the yourself those things or the existence of them. I have big problems with that. I totally sympathize.
Well, it's like, it's those, just like we always say how, like, we've heard these, like, religious lessons, like love reigns supreme, don't, like, love is always the answer type thing, and like how we have to keep reminding, like that's what it is. It's like a way to ritualistically remind yourself, like, oh right, the love, like my, like gaming the system to win in my stand up career. That doesn't, like, remember, just like, no, love is the,
no, love comes out of that
too. Zero. Zero. Cool. I do you have what kind of community would you like in this religion? Like, what kind of, like,
you know, just like super cool hot people that,
very stylistic people too,
that, you know, as long as they're like good looking and really smart and like and chill and fun and just the kind of people that you would want to be around all the time.
Yeah.
And I'm not against people who are not like that being following these ideas and beliefs as well, but I don't want to be around them.
Cool.
No, I don't know. The only answer I can give to that question is just people, you know, who feel similarly about these things. And I mean, I'm increasingly interested in talking to people about them. I don't know if I'm yet at the point where I want to start actually trying to formalize my religious practice or my spiritual practice, but it is a long-term goal of mine.
I've been toying with that the past year of, like, I mean, part of that's part of the impetus of the podcast is, like, how could I reconcile my own individualistic sort of opinions and takes and beliefs and philosophies with, and how could they possibly fit in any given community? Because it seems like the philosophy, it is so important and so such an easy, like, necessary way to build a community is to find like-minded people, find people who are on the same philosophical wavelength. I think where I've started to soften is, like, the specific beliefs of, like, the of, like, how, like, what, whether Jesus is real, whether he was really the Son of God, those don't really matter to me as much anymore.
I don't think they're a huge deal. I think most of these things are like, they're powerful symbols and parables.
Yeah.
And the, I mean, I have a friend, Zach, who's made a real interesting argument to me, which is he's like, all these like Westerners who study Eastern religion, they're completely misguided. That like, that's all tied up in a set of like cultural symbols that we are totally deaf to and unaware of. He's like, the reality of it is, whether you like it or not, the language of your culture is just inextricably tied up with the religion and mythology of Christianity and Judaism. And, you know, that's like, it reminds me too of like in the 60s and stuff, when all these great filmmakers are making, they might be atheists, but they're making these films that have all this religious symbolism in them, because they want powerful symbols and they want to, you know, use them to invoke powerful things in people.
Yeah, it's about effective communication at the end of the day. Like, what's going to be the easiest way for people to understand what I'm talking about, like what I'm getting at.
And it's very, very hard to get people to see, to be awe-inspired by the universe, to have those moments where you feel absolutely overwhelmed by the nature of existence in a cynical, in an uncynical and vulnerable way. So, well, it's almost like any way you can get at it, you know?
Yeah, I think what helped me, because I studied Eastern religions for a while, and now I'm not totally leaning on them exclusively, but I think they can be useful when you have baggage tied to like your own Western shit, and you're like, you have such a bad taste in your mouth with any of that. It's like, then you see the outsider perspective of the same concepts. I didn't even realize they were the same concepts for the longest time. And I'm like, oh shit, they are kind of talking about the same thing.
No, totally. And there's tons of great wisdom in those things too. I should say, I don't completely sign off with my friend Zach's position.
Right, right.
I just think it's a real like interesting way, and I think it's nice because it does some service to all the Judeo-Christian stuff, which it's so common these days. I feel like to be like, oh, that's all good, we should get rid of that as quickly as possible and just drink Soylent.
Yeah,
like, you know, don't worry, iTunes is here, you know.
Right. Well, that it, you know, and that what I agree with him too, and like in that similar vein, Ram Dass is a big kind of spiritual teacher. I love listening to his lectures, and something I've mentioned on the podcast before, but I'll mention again, is like this idea of honoring your incarnation. It's like, I don't have to believe in the specific, like, I can know my great grandparents believed in a different version of Christian, like a more literalistic interpretation of it. And I can just, but I don't have to damn it either. I can play with it.
Yeah.
I can have like a loving, like a detachment with it, you know?
Oh, completely. I think that there is absolutely nothing wrong with that approach.
Yeah. And is there any kind of, what's your take on like outreach or any kind of like
recruitment?
Yeah. I'm not going to say evangelistic.
No, I know what you mean. I am, my personal form of outreach is having conversations like this. And those conversations include and I hope that at some point I'll meet people that are way more spiritually enlightened than I am.
Yeah.
And just continuing to have authentic exchanges with people. At some point, I would like to live in a communal living scenario or whatever, and maybe that will be built around like ideas that I feel are both like intellectually, spiritually evolved. But for the time being, you know, I'm still I'm just in the baby steps, so I'm not trying to pull anyone in.
What's any kind of rules on your religion? Any kind of like, don't do this, do this?
Yeah, I mean, that, you know, to me, I know this is like, it doesn't really even say anything, but it's like, just, you know, just please no cruelty, like no harm for pleasure's sake. Like, that's kind of thing is wrong.
It's the highest of like selfish behavior. It's not just selfish that's like has no victim. It's knowing there's a victim.
Yeah.
And being selfish
and relishing that. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool, man. So this is the hardest part, is like, is there a name that we can come up with for this
Universalism.
Unitarian Universalism.
Coming up with a name,
or a catchphrase or something.
The universe is waking up.
There we go. Cool, man. thanks so much for coming on. This is a great talk.
Oh, Joe, thanks so much for having me.
This is awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that is the show, everyone. Thank you so much for tuning in. If you're in Los Angeles, again, check out Bigfoot Lodge every Sunday night at 9 p.m. Babe Island is the show name. Check it out. And check out Thrift, the web series that Miles Run talking about fashion. And if you like this show, subscribe on iTunes and Stitcher. ChooseYourOwnReligion.com for old episodes. And I love you. Jamen.
What's a Creative Podcast Network?